Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here in the holiday season, 17 minutes past the hour. Do want to remind everybody, it's been a long time coming, but since yesterday was the day that the electors cast their ballots, tomorrow the amazing Kreskin will be on this show at 8:30 a.m. live, and we will open up his prediction for the 2020 election. Now remember, he sent this prediction to me back in mid-October under the pretense that I would not look at this, I would not open it until after the election of 2020 presidential, and he was on the air with me when I would open it. So I have had this in my possession since the middle of October. Who would have thought it would have taken this long to open this thing? But tomorrow morning, we will finally open it here in mid-December with the amazing Kreskin live on the line. And I can promise you, I have not looked at the answer. So we'll see how that all goes tomorrow morning at 8:30. Now, as I say, we are in the midst of the holiday season, and it's getting toward the end of the year, and there are certain people you like to have on, who you have on many times over the year. A regular guest on this program is certainly our guest this hour, and could not be a better day to have her on the day after the electoral votes were cast, because it has been a crazy year. It's been a crazy couple months when it comes to the presidential election of 2020, which maybe is running neck and neck with the pandemic of 2020 as the big stories of 2020. So we turn to our friend, many-time visitor to this program, for her analysis here in the holiday season. She is a contributor to the Daily Beast and a panelist on the long-running television series The McLachlan Group. And by the way, if that show is not on in your area, you can watch it on YouTube. Just search McLachlan Group or Eleanor Clift. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones in the holiday season, Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Glad to be with you, and lots to talk about, as always.
Absolutely. Now, Eleanor, right off the top, I want to ask you, because I know you spent some time in Ohio with your husband, what do you make of the changing of the Cleveland Indians name after 105 years?
That was an issue that we discussed. My husband has been dead 15 years, so, and we had vigorous discussions about that in the years preceding. So this has been an active topic for a long time. My late husband, Tom Brazaitis, was a bureau chief in Washington to the Cleveland Plain Dealer and then a columnist. And he was a fan of Chief Wahoo, Chief Wahoo got retired some years ago, I guess, and now comes the inevitable name change. And here in Washington, D.C., where we live together, the Washington Redskins have finally changed their name as well. So I think there's an increased awareness that these are epithets to some people, and they don't really belong in the names of sports teams that we cheer. So I think it's time, and I think that's what's happened in Cleveland and Ohio as well.
You know, Eleanor, the interesting thing about that yesterday was that, you know, I'm sure there were people pressuring them, groups, to change the name for years, but these are private teams owned by private people, and it seemed like the outcry about changing the name seemed to be bigger than the outcry to change. People didn't want it changed. Now, maybe that's just what the fallout yesterday.
Some fans were really attached. I wouldn't put my late husband in that category. I think he you know, he would accept a name change. But the original name was part of the whole ethos around the team, and people who are real diehard fans, you know, thought that you could not, you know, extricate the name and still have the same team. So there are some people who are not going to like this, but I actually think in recent years the whole dispute has calmed down. We have so much more, you know, bigger things to worry about in this country that I think the fact that they finally changed the name, they did it at a time when the overt opposition had waned. It's almost like you forgot about it and you thought, okay, well, that was a fight. It's over. Nothing's going to change. And then all of a sudden, it changed. It's like so many things happen. You know, if nothing happens, nothing happens. And then all of a sudden, a big change occurs. And I think that's what happened here. And people had almost forgotten about it, except maybe some who pay extra close attention. But in the broader scheme, it was certainly not a headline-making fight anymore. And then all of a sudden, people behind the scenes, I think, recognized the world had changed, and there's new generations, and new generations are on the side of not being overtly offensive to certain demographics in our history and people who live among us today. It just seems like, you know, why have this gratuitous insult? And I know the people who defend it don't see it as an insult, but you have to listen to the people who are offended, and a majority there did see it as an insult.
Eleanor, the election of 2020 continues on. Yesterday we had the voting of the Electoral College, which normally doesn't get a whole lot of attention, but certainly did yesterday, certainly is this morning. What did that mean for this strange election of 2020?
Well, the news this morning is that the Russian President Vladimir Putin actually sent a telegram to President-elect Biden congratulating him. So Putin sees this as a decisive moment, and it's kind of ironic that he would react and we would still have leading members of the Republican Party still trying to pretend that this the election really isn't over. I was thinking that Mitch McConnell, who is really the leader of the Republican Party, that he would see this moment of the Electoral College making it official, that he would call to congratulate his friend and former colleague. He and Joe Biden have known each other for probably 3 decades. Maybe that has happened behind the scenes. Both sides are kind of coy about who they've talked to and who they haven't talked to, but it's time for Mitch McConnell to make a public call to Biden and congratulate him. They're going to be working together on the country's problems in, what, not quite 40 days. So he's the person I'm waiting to hear from. A few more Republicans have now step forward and acknowledged a reality, but the speech that the president-elect gave yesterday, he has been very mindful of wanting to lower the temperature in the country, political divisiveness, but he took a somewhat stronger tone yesterday, pointing out that this was an attempt to invalidate the votes of 20 million people. And the number of people who were engaged in this maneuver on the Republican side, I don't know whether he used the word shameful, but if he didn't, he should have, pointing out that it really does undermine trust in our electoral system and trust in our democracy. So he took a somewhat stronger tone yesterday, recounting the fact that some 50 lawsuits were brought by the Republicans. I think one was successful and had nothing to do with the outcome, and that the Supreme Court, with three Republican appointed seats by Trump himself, plus a conservative majority on the court, rejected not once but twice these bogus lawsuits. So he commended the fact that the center held, the democracy held, our courts held, courts with judges appointed by Trump himself and by Republican judges, and they all basically saw this for what it was, which was a bogus attempt to overturn an election. But I don't think too many people alive today would think we would have ever seen an attempt by a sitting president to change the outcome of an election that he lost. I mean, it's not something we've dealt with before in this country, and we still have a couple of weeks left wondering what else President Trump might be doing. And the exit of his Attorney General, William Barr, just weeks before the term expires, tells you something about how, in my view, that the Attorney General does not want to be associated with whatever Trump might have in mind these last weeks. So it's quite an extraordinary time. But the Biden-Harris ticket won. They've won several times. There have been recounts. They've been, you know, states have certified. It's kind of ironic that it was Trump who always said we would be winning so much we'd get tired of winning. Now it's the Biden team on this election that they're winning so much, and yet there are still some Republicans left who don't want to acknowledge the fact that that Biden won by more than 7 million votes and an electoral count of 306 votes, which was exactly what Trump got 4 years ago, and Trump called it a landslide. So there is reality out there.
What at this point is the thinking behind this with Attorney General Barr out of this, with Giuliani down with COVID-19, with the Supreme Court passing on this? At this point, what is the thinking of the Republican lawmakers and the president as to why this should be overturned? Early on, it was the votes were wrong and things were put in garbage cans and all this sort of thing. But at this point, what is the thinking?
Yeah, I really don't think there are many, if any, people in Republican leadership who actually think that Trump won the election and that the election results should be overturned. But I do think that they like the energy around the resisting the outcome. And there are these two runoff races in Georgia, January 5th, and the Republican thinking has been that you need to keep the fire going so that Republicans will come out and vote. It's a little bit of a mixed message because President Trump and others are saying the election is rigged, and yet they're asking people to go out and vote in races in a system that they have condemned as rigged. It's a little bit of a back and forth, and I think the confusing message has actually made it possible that the Democrats might win one or both of those races, which would have been unthinkable not that long ago in a red state like Georgia. So it's keeping the energy and the excitement specifically for those two races. And then I think it's really about it's fear of how Trump will excoriate people if they don't stick by him. And if Trump excoriates you, you then have problems from his voters, who are very dedicated to him and believe what he said, and you have Republicans worried they're going to face a primary challenge from the right, from Trump people, if they don't show sufficient loyalty to the president. So it's about political survival, and Republicans are fearful that the president has such a dedicated following, and in fairness, he got more votes than any other presidential candidate in history, except for Biden. So he's got a lot of people out there who believe in him and who believe him when he says that this election was stolen from him. So those voters could take out their anger on Republicans who don't stick with the president. So it's about politics. It's about fear of Trump and fear of his followers, and he has so taken over the Republican Party that if you're a Republican and you lose Trump's followers, who are you left with? You're not left with a winning number of people. So it's political survival, which is why Republicans, I think, are acting this way in defying what has been obvious since shortly after Election Day, and that is that Joe Biden won.
For President Trump at this point, as you say, he certainly has a lot of followers, and they're going to stick with him no matter what happens on January 20th. What at this point is the man's idea to keep going on this way after all these things have happened, Supreme Court and AG Barr and the Electoral College voting? For him at this point, they're not going to leave him. So why continue with this? Just not wanting to lose?
Yeah. Karl Rove, a very well-respected Republican strategist, said over the weekend that Trump is sort of teetering on this line of looking like he's making a heroic last stand and being a sore loser. At some point, this looks like he just can't handle losing, and that he's willing to do virtually anything to try to retain power, which is not how we behave in a democratic small d country. And he's also looking at his post-presidential life, and he views himself as someone who can retain a political following over the next 4 years, so that any Republican who wants to run for president would have to come to Mar-a-Lago, I guess, which is where he's going to live mostly, to get his blessing. He might well hold himself out as a potential presidential candidate, kind of freezing the field for the Republicans. I personally don't think he'll run again, because the fear of potentially losing, I think, would be too great. But he could declare a presidential campaign. He could raise money. He could have rallies. He could, in his mind, have virtually the same life after the presidency that he had as president, in terms of tweeting, having people follow what he says, holding rallies where people will come and show their devotion. Now, the question is, does that continue indefinitely, or is there kind of an expiration date on this behavior? I think I'm on the side of thinking there's an expiration date, but the Republican Party at this point, I'm not sure they know what they stand for, what their policies are. Will anybody who chooses to stand up and say they're interested in running be in the Trumpian mold? Not necessarily his behavior, but his views. That will have a hold on the Republican Party as well. So Trump just wants to stay relevant, I think, and he wants to be center stage. He wants attention, and I think there's going to be a lot of pressure in the mainstream media not to camp out in Mar-a-Lago and treat him like a president in exile. But I think there's a whole conservative media network that may well treat him that way. So this is, you know, it's a cliche to say it, but it's uncharted territory. I can't remember, certainly in my lifetime, any other president who's lost after a single term who leaves office and appears to be, you know, as powerful as he was while holding office. I can't think of anything that's at all like that. The closest I can come to is George Wallace, who ran as a Democrat, and I think, and after he lost, he was a kingmaker, because the Democrats either had to bring his people into their fold, or the Republicans needed to make their appeal. So he ran and lost. He, of course, never became president, but he ran and lost in the primaries, but he still was a considerable, he was a powerful figure within the Democratic Party and within presidential politics. But that's the closest analogy I can come up with.
In just a little over 30 days, on January 20th, 2021, is there any chance that President Trump will be sitting there while Joe Biden takes the oath of office, and that he will be walked to the plane, as we have seen every time?
You know, on one of the McLaughlin group you mentioned, we always do these awards shows at the end, and we taped them a week ago, actually. And one of the questions was, will he attend the inauguration? All the panelists said no. Tom Rogan, the moderator, said he thought he would. We don't know, obviously, but I said no, because based on the president's current behavior, I can't imagine him riding in a limousine to Capitol Hill with Joe Biden. Of course, I guess that wouldn't happen anyway because of the pandemic, now that I think about it. So conceivably, he could be there virtually. The only thing that makes me wonder, maybe he will, is he can turn on a dime. He has changed his mind a number of times, certainly on pieces of legislation and on, you know, who he supports. And I mean, this William Barr is leaving, but the president has been threatening to fire him ever since he said that the election was free and fair. So the president can turn, and his followers will turn right along with him, and he could. Actually, you know, justify this and say that yes, he respects the democratic processes, and he will and might show up. I think the odds are probably against it, but you know, Trump can do anything as long as it's a grand gesture and it gets lots of attention. And you got to think in terms, he's the reality TV producer. So what's the twist that will be the surprise end that all the reviewers will write about after months of believing that he would have nothing to do with this peaceful transition of power? He shows up. So I guess it would be a surprise ending.
You know, one of the main problems with that whole inauguration might be that since Joe Biden announced he was running for president, and all throughout acceptance speeches and speeches he has given, it has been the fight for the soul of the country. Now, not mentioning Trump a whole lot by name, but that's pretty well been the idea. And if that's the inauguration speech, President Trump might show up, but he also might walk out. If that's the tenor of the
speech.
All right,
well, that would be another plot twist, wouldn't it?
That I can see happening. That I can see going on.
Right. Well, and that would fulfill his deed to be in the lead paragraph. he would get top billing. You know, Joe Biden delivering his, in the midst of it, former president, you know, walked off the stage. So he wants top billing, and that would be a way to get pretty much near the top. We'll see. I mean, it would be fascinating to see all of the body language of everybody trying to conduct themselves in appropriate ways. If in fact he did show up, he can be very charming, and he knows what he's supposed to do, and. He could well pull it off in a gentlemanly way, but then he does have these rages and these impulses where he really can't control himself. I mean, so your scenario might well be that he decides to be on good behavior and then just can't take it and leaves the stage. Well, that would be interesting.
And I'm not sure exactly how this will all take place during this pandemic world we live in, but is there still the idea that on this stage, on January 20th, you could have President Trump, you could have then President Biden, you could have former President Obama, Hillary Clinton, President Clinton, and Michelle Obama, and after all the water that's went under the bridge with that group over the last 4 years, that's an uncomfortable stage, I would think.
Well, I don't think so. First of all, they'd all be 6 feet apart.
Well, that's
because
good.
Because they'd
that's
have to
good.
Be socially distanced. You know, George W. Bush and Michelle Obama seem to have bonded. They exchanged jokes and so forth. And I don't think there's any bad blood there. And Hillary has certainly taken her share of the grief and the pain over the loss in 2016. And you know, Bill Clinton is a controversial person, but he delivered in 2012 a speech at the convention in praise and support of Obama that Obama couldn't do for himself. So I think they've all delivered in their own way, and they've kind of shared the pain and the joy of being both losers and winners in different ways.
I
think that's okay, but you know, what I remember from the 2016 inauguration, which was actually in 2017, when the then new President Trump delivered what was called a kind of an American Carnage speech, and afterwards, apparently George W. Bush, who was seated next to Hillary Clinton, said something to the effect that was some weird stuff. Although he didn't say stuff, he used a different word. So they get along well enough.
I think the former presidents and first ladies will be fine. I just think over the last 4 years, with President Trump being president, the things that have been said and the things that were said during this campaign, I would think that Hillary Clinton and President Obama and Michelle Obama and this whole idea of not accepting the election results, they're probably not very fond of President Trump at this point.
No, because he really has broken all the rules on everything. But he spent 4 years disparaging Barack Obama and trying to erase Barack Obama's signature achievement, Obamacare. He has failed at it, but he also, pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. He tried to move forward as though the Obama administration didn't really exist, tried to do away with DACA, the support for the Dreamers. Yes, and so, there's no love lost. And then Hillary Clinton, I mean, his most recent rallies, he still leads his supporters in chants, lock her up. So, yeah, no, your point is well taken there. If Trump is on the stage, you know, where would you seat him? And I guess he would wear a mask, I guess. He's now relented, at least in some instances, when he's in public wearing a mask.
It's an interesting, I think, juxtaposition when it comes to this. Now, the other thing that I think we're all waiting for after the first of the year is the televised farewell address from the Oval Office that the president usually gives. What's that going to be like? Is that going to happen?
Well, you know, if he has to acknowledge that he's leaving, it might be difficult. What is more amazing is that we're on the verge of having 300,000 people die from the coronavirus this year, and he has never done any kind of, I don't know, shared mourning, a speech sort of feeling the grief and the pain that people experience in this country. He's dedicated all these months since these months since the election to, you know, fighting for his own survival as a politician without any really acknowledgement of the pain in the country. So I don't know. It's hard to think that he would pass up a chance to address the country. And I think he probably has people around him who will write a speech that's appropriate to the moment, but then he will, I imagine that he would not be able to resist airing his grievances at the same time. So I don't know, I hadn't given much thought as to whether that would happen or not. He does play an increasingly smaller role on the public stage. He pardoned the turkeys for Thanksgiving, and I gather he, you know, was there to light the Christmas tree. He's had a meeting with his vaccine companies, but he's at very, very few public events. So I don't know whether he'll choose to kind of quietly leave the White House in December and go to Mar-a-Lago, which would be what he normally might do over these holidays, and then not come back, or whether he will do what exiting presidents do, give a speech that is mindful of his legacy. I think probably, as I talk through this, I think probably people will tell him it's important to set the stage as he leaves the White House, and so I imagine he will make some sort of a speech.
When it comes to January 20th, President Trump, for all intents and purposes, will no longer be a sitting president. Now, a big question has been, you cannot indict a sitting president. We have seen stories since Election Day, and some before that, but definitely since Election Day, definitely since Joe Biden was pretty much declared the winner by the Associated Press, that these cases are amping up in New York against President Trump. The criminal cases, there will be civil cases with women, definitely, that will continue now. But the criminal cases, are they going, is there a possibility for indictment very quick after January 20th? Are these serious matters? Are these matters that face jail time, are unpardonable because they're state crimes and not national crime, federal crimes?
Well, they are unpardonable because they are state crimes, and the Southern District of New York and the Attorney General of New York are proceeding quite aggressively. Tax fraud crimes, fraudulent behavior in inflating the value of assets when it's convenient and downgrading them when it's not. And then I think there's a big family-owned property that they have taken lots of write-offs, claiming it's a family-type residence when, in fact, it's used for lots of other things. It's the kind of things that his former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, has served some time for. So the potential is there that the president could be indicted, convicted, and actually go to jail. But if I had to put odds on that, I'd say they're very low, that he would actually go to jail. White-collar crimes is what this sounds like. Usually, they don't serve a lot of time unless you have a prosecutor who wants to make an example of the person. Martha Stewart comes to mind on insider trading, that she actually served time for something that a lot of other people got a slap on the wrist for. So making an example out of he still is a former president, and there is still respect for the office and for him. But the zeal with which he is trying to remain in office suggests that he has sufficient reason to fear what could happen next, and what the impact that would have on his bottom line and on his status and on his Trump enterprises. So he could be in a world of financial difficulty. And then there are all kinds of conflicts of interest. You know, going forward as a former president, he gets Secret Service protection. And even now, he stays at his properties, and the Secret Service rents room at his properties, and it's a kind of, it kind of smacks a little bit of financial self-dealing here. And so I think, you know, the Biden administration is going to be in an awkward position of trying to, you know, draw some lines to avoid some of these ethical conflicts without looking like, without looking or without actually trying to go after his predecessor. I mean, I think Biden does truly want to turn the page here and is not really incentivized to go after his predecessor. But there are a lot of Democrats who would like to, would like to see Trump hauled off and put in jail. I'm not gonna say that that's not true. There's a lot of anger on both sides in this country.
We don't know how the cases or trials or plea or whatever would happen there. We don't know what would happen. But do you foresee an indictment fairly quickly after the 20th of January on something?
I think that, well, that's quite possible, because they've been working these cases for some time. So, so they may have all the ducks in a row. And Deutsche Bank, which is the bank that bankrolled the president, has cooperated. They've had the records of his accountant in New York, and the president has resisted these inquiries and has been able to put them off because he is a sitting president. But that's not to say that the work and the investigation has gone on. So I think your speculation could be correct that there could be some pretty swift moves after he leaves office.
Now, a big question that a lot of people are worried about, door to door, house to house: where are we with the stimulus package? We have heard for a long time it was going to be another $1,200, then it was going to be $1,500 if you take the vaccine, then it was going to be $600, then it was going to be no direct payments. Where are we on this?
You know, the latest is that they still can't come to an agreement over liability protection for business, which is what McConnell has put out there as a must-have requirement. And the Democrats want aid to cities and states, which the Republicans see as a bailout for blue states, which is actually not true because red states are suffering as well. But those are the two points of contention. And it's held up aid for months, and it continues to hold up aid. And the last agreement shaved the amount of money. It took off the money for the cities and states in retribution for not agreeing on the liability protection. So they're now looking at a $700-plus a deal. And I don't know whether it includes any direct payments. You have an interesting a collaboration with Bernie Sanders on the progressive left and Josh Hawley on, I want to call, the innovative right, calling for $1,200 direct payment checks and $500 direct payment to children, which is modeled after what they did in the spring, soon after the pandemic was really raging, and they did that cooperatively with both parties. And the Republicans are resisting that. They're saying it's too much money, and they don't like the fact that they can't somehow weed out people who shouldn't be getting the checks, which is not the same resistance they showed when the money was going to corporations. And the after-action report on the aid to businesses shows that a lot of big corporations who had no business getting money that was meant for small businesses got it. But that doesn't seem to deter the politicians there. I don't know. It kind of bothers me that they worry so much more about a small number of individuals maybe getting money that they didn't need, whereas they turn a blind eye to businesses getting money they surely didn't need. And the gap, monetary gap, between the two is huge. But Having said all that, where the direct payments to individuals stands, here's where the president could wade in and maybe have an impact. He supports the direct payment to individuals, and he'd like to have his name on the check. Fine, if that satisfies him. It doesn't bother me. But he has not really taken much of an interest in what's going on. So we're in the last stages this week of whether they can potentially bring this off. And I've got to believe they come up with something, because, again, those runoff races in Georgia, the Republicans need them to maintain their power in the Senate. And it's very hard for those Republican senators to go home and say, you know, keep the Senate Republican, but we can't deliver aid. Be much nicer if they would have an aid package they could go back to the campaign trail with. So I still think they're going to get something, but whether it's going to be what's needed, I think it'll fall far short of what's needed.
You know, Eleanor, I think one of the problems that people are really finding it hard to understand is that essentially the same people are there who were there in April when the first stimulus package came through. And at that time, far fewer people had the COVID-19. The hospitals were not filled up. They are now at 90% capacity, a lot of them. More people have it. Over 300,000 people have died, and this was not, that was supposed to be an unthought of high-end number. Now we've surpassed that before the end of the year. But they can't get together on it now. Is it just the what we want, what we don't want? Why were they able to get together on it then when things were less bad?
Because the newness of it and the shock of it was there. I mean, I'm not saying that we've, quote, normalized what's going on, but, we as a country are not as mobilized as we should be this far into the pandemic. Initially, you know, President Trump could have been a real hero, and I think it would have sealed his reelection if he had put the country on a war footing, which he said it was a war, and, you know, used the Defense Production Act to make sure that tests were available to everyone, did everything to help maintain the schools are open. There's so many missed opportunities here. At this point, I don't know. It's unfathomable to me to think that this Congress, they all get good health care, they've all got good salaries, they've all able to work from home, that they can't comprehend the pain in this country of people dying, being unable to work, being sick, schools closed, bread lines, food lines, and not reacting in unity the way they did quickly in April. It's, you're right, it's worse now, and the old partisan differences have just taken hold. I mean, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, you're gonna blame the other side. I mean, I tend to see Mitch McConnell as the major roadblock here, and you would think that they could find wording about giving some sort of immunity to businesses without making it such a blanket immunity that that people could do all sorts of things and not be liable. I don't know what the back and forth is, but surely they could find some wording to do that, and I still hope that will happen before they leave town.
Eleanor, a quick final question here. Time magazine named their Person of the Year last week, and it was President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. Did you think, is that the story of 2020? I really thought it was going to be Dr. Fauci or something to do with the pandemic.
Yeah. Actually, if they were going to name two people, and it is Biden and Harris. You could have named Fauci and all the health providers. I'm sure inside, do they get honorary mention? Understanding why the magazine is doing that, I think they want to look forward, and they want to put out the promise of turning the page, which is what the language that Biden used in his speech last night. But the healthcare workers who have been on the front lines and people now getting the vaccinations, I mean, they are the true heroes of this. And, I mean, history's going to look back. And I love the comments of some of the people in the UK who were the first to get the vaccine. It was one 91-year-old man was asked why he was getting the vaccine, and he said, "Well, I haven't died yet. I don't want to live this long and die with the virus." And it was nice. And so I think the promise ahead, and I think Biden and Harris, if you're a magazine editor, you can say they embody science, and they're going to get us through this. And one final note, give credit to President Trump. He did light the fire under the scientists and the pharmaceutical companies and the FDA and all that, his Operation Warp Speed. He did get us to this point. I'm perfectly happy to give him every bit of credit that he deserves.
Very nice. Eleanor, it's great to talk to you during the holiday season. I hope you have a happy and merry Christmas and holiday season, and I'm sure we will talk again as the Inauguration Day looms forward.
Yes.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Okay, thank you, Scott.
Bye-bye. Eleanor Clift. All right, coming up later on today, Voice of the People with Linda Sims, 4:10 to 5 p.m., The Adam the Computer Guy Show, 2:10 to 3. For this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
And keep an eye out for the WWGH News Chopper flying high overhead.
NewsForce is a new kind of news organization in Marion, Ohio. Stay up to the trusted source. We are.